It recording. And it will also get started to
where'd that go? Okay, keep yourself muted unless you really need to talk. I'm going to mute myself pretty quickly. I'm going to first recognize Jack Gaffey. Tell us about what the Mid-Atlantic Senior Physics Group is going to do this month, Jack.
The APS Mid-Atlantic Senior Physics Group will have a talk on Wednesday, March 16. The speaker is Garrigan Popwine from the Biology Department at the University of Maryland. And the title is Modeling Biomolecular Structure and Dynamics by Blending Ideas from Machine Learning with Physics. There is a link to the announcement in the calendar section on page 7 of Stardust.
Okay, which is in National Capital Astronomers newsletter, which probably most of you have gotten probably via email from.
Everybody's welcome.
Right. Everybody's welcome at both our meeting and their meeting. You don't have to pay money. Though if you do want to, if you're a student, you can join for $5. And if you're not a student, we'll bankrupt you to the tune of $10 a year. And then you're officially a member. Let me see. David Dunham, is there anything you need to tell us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, David.
Okay. There's a major occultation coming up 2 weeks from tonight. It's an occultation of a 10th magnitude star a few degrees north of the Pleiades. That's going to be occulted by the asteroid Palmamelli, or Palemami, I think it is pronounced. It's a Trojan asteroid, and it's a target of the NASA's Lucy mission. So the Lucy project is mounting a big major expedition to observe it. And the path extends from western Kansas to the North Carolina coast near Wilmington. They're planning major efforts with mobile observatories and a few fixed site observatories in the path. IOTA's coordinating, cooperating with them. And you can find some information about it if you go to the webpage, the iota.jhuapl.edu /expat.htm webpage, the link given at the bottom of the occultations in Stardust. Anyway, we're going to try to observe it. The big wild card is the weather, of course. We don't know where in the path the clear sky is going to be. And they'll make a decision about 5 days in advance with the best weather information they have then, whether to head towards either Nashville, Tennessee, which is their middle, sort of a middle position, or Asheville, North Carolina, or a western location like Rolla, Missouri. So we're going to be driving ourselves, and depending on the weather forecast, we will, shift our position. And after that occultation, we're going to drive back to Maryland and spend 2 weeks in Maryland and then come back here to Arizona for a couple of months before a return to the DC area for the summer.
Thank you for that announcement, David. Are there any other announcements for the good of the order? I have one that I talked about earlier, but that was before we started recording on April the 2nd. That's a Saturday, so that's before our next meeting at the Eisenhower Memorial in DC. If you have a telescope and you want to show other people's stuff from 6 till about 10, our friend from Hofstra University will be there, because we're pretty sure that Eisenhower started NASA and got him to be a civilian agency, and we're commemorating that and showing people the sky. So if you want to come and have a telescope or if you just want to come and look through somebody else's telescope, I will be there with a Questar and a solar filter if the sun will still be up then in April on at 6 when we start. So that announcement's finished. Are there any other announcements before I turn the before I mute myself and turn the meeting over to John to introduce our speaker?
This is David again. I just have one announcement. On the morning of March 16th, there's going to be an occultation of an eighth magnitude star by Venus that will be visible just from the eastern coast of the U.S. It'll be in, you know, kind of bright twilight for the Washington area. I think it's best around Indiana or so, but it's a possibility for those with large scopes and occulting bars that they can put in the prime focus to block the dazzling light of Venus. It'll be possible to see the reappearance of the star on the dark side of Venus. And this is, you know, just of course a little, you know, an hour or so before sunrise on March 16th. So we'll be having a webpage. I'll send a message about it to the National
Listservers
mailing list.
Thank you, David. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other announcements before I let John go on and I mute myself? Good to see your face, Dave. Now I'm going to mute myself and you start, John.
Okay, our speaker this evening is Dr. Ira Thorpe, an astrophysicist in the gravitational lab at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He has both Bachelor of Arts in Physics and a Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and a Master's degree in Physics from the University of Maryland and a PhD in Physics from the University of Florida. Almost immediately after beginning his work towards his PhD, Ira put his combination of expertise in mechanical engineering and in physics to use, working with both a benchtop model and a simulator of the future laser interferometry space antenna, whose acronym is LISA, L-I-S-A. The topic of his PhD thesis in physics from the University of Florida was on that same topic. And LISA is a very important experiment, because it will enable the detection of G waves having much lower frequencies than those detected by ground detectors. There are many more sources of low frequency G waves than of high frequency G waves. So during the forthcoming LISA era, G wave astronomy will be detecting huge numbers of events instead of the relatively few that are detected now. In that respect, it will become much more like ordinary astronomy. After earning his PhD, Dr. Thorpe came to the Goddard Space Flight Center, where he's now NASA lead scientist on LISA. From 2015 to 2017, he was NASA's liaison to the European Space Agency's LISA Pathfinder mission, a technology demonstration spaceflight that validated key aspects of the LISA measurement technique. Dr. Thorpe.
All right. Thank you very much. Can you all hear me okay? Just a thumbs up or so. Okay. Thanks for that introduction. And thank you for inviting me to speak with your club. I'm sorry we can't do it in person. And yes, I'm going to talk with you about LISA. I've been working on LISA for quite a while. I'd like to say I've been working on it for about 20 years, and I think I'm halfway done. It's going to still takes a while to do these big missions, and we'll talk about all of that. So let me go share my screen here and get my talk up and get it into the slideshow mode. Okay, can we all see the screen all right? All right, I see some indications there. So again, I'm going to speak with you about the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, or LISA as we like to call it. And as John just alluded to, this is about doing gravitational wave astronomy from space. So we want to build a space-based detector observatory of gravitational waves. This is an international effort It's led by the European Space Agency. NASA is a major junior partner, so that's why you see ESA and NASA in the LISA logo there. There's also a group called the LISA Consortium, which is a sort of grassroots community organization, which represents about 1,500 scientists across the globe, and also represents some of the European funding agencies that are part, you know, sort of member states of ESA that contribute to the mission in various ways. Okay, so the first part of my talk, I want to just explain, you know, why we want to do LISA before I explain what it is. And it's all about gravitational waves. And when I gave these talks at the beginning of my career on LISA, I usually would have to start by explaining what a gravitational wave was. But, you know, thanks to LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, which is a ground-based gravitational wave detector, which also took about 40 years from conception to first detection, we now have gravitational waves as being fairly common knowledge, at least amongst the people that are interested in science. So what I've plotted here on the screen is the very first gravitational wave that was detected by humans. And what you're seeing here are actually ripples in the fabric of space-time, and they are caused by the collision of two black holes that were about 20 or 30 times the mass of our sun. And if you see just the plot here, it's a time series, and you see the time is evolving over a small fraction of a second. There's a few tenths of a second plotted there. And on the vertical axis, you're seeing a number called strain. And you mentioned I had a mechanical engineering background. This is one of the things that's useful. I know what strain is. It's a change in length over length. It's a dimensionless quantity. That's what we use to quantify the amplitude of gravitational waves, because it's space itself that's stretching. The farther apart you put two reference objects, the more distance you will see change between them. So if I put them a meter apart, I'll see this 10 to the minus 21 meters. The real LIGO detectors are about a few kilometers in length. And so they see 10 to the minus 18, 10 to the minus 19 meter changes in their detectors. Obviously, they have to have exquisitely sensitive detectors to see this. But what you're seeing in the two colors are ripples of space-time as these that are caused by these two black holes orbiting one another. And the sheet on the right is actually giving an idea of some of the information that can be pulled out of this, and I'll explain how that's all done. But the one I wanted to focus in on is a part of the table that says source masses. So you can see there was two black holes, and they have a range of masses, but their total mass was about 65 solar masses between the two of them. And they collided and eventually formed a remnant black hole, which had 62 solar masses. And you know, when people first encounter this, a lot of times they think, oh, that's just sort of the measurement errors. But that's actually not the case. There's a measured difference between the sum of the two masses of the black holes that collided and the remnant black hole that's left over. And you can see that over on the right, there's a radiated gravitational wave energy. It's a few solar masses. So that's just showing you that that's the amount of energy that is produced by these by this kind of gravitational wave merger. So you had three solar masses of energy that was created and turned into gravitational waves. So people sometimes say gravitational waves are weak. So they're certainly not. That gives you the idea to take three solar mass times C squared, you get quite a lot of energy. All right, next slide. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about those gravitational waveforms. So the plot that I have here is showing a fit to actually that same type of waveform after it's been just smoothed and filtered a little bit to get rid of some of the high frequency noise. And so you see it's sort of like a sine wave, and it has two main characteristics. Its frequency is increasing with time, so the waves are getting closer together, and the amplitude is increasing with time, the waves are getting bigger. And that's a feature of when you have a merger of two objects. So early on, and what you're encoding is really the orbital motion of these two objects. And for basically because there's a symmetry between the two objects, we see a frequency that's twice the orbital frequency. So whether they're on this side or on this side, we still see the same gravitational wave. So we see a frequency that's at twice the orbital frequency. So because in a normal Keplerian orbit, these things would be stable, but because of general relativity, you're actually emitting a little bit of gravitational waves as you orbit something. The Earth is emitting a small amount of gravitational waves as it orbits the sun. That carries energy away from the system. That energy has to come from somewhere. And so the only place that energy can come from is from the orbit itself. So those two objects have to fall towards one another in order to compensate for the gravitational wave energy that was carried out of the system. Now, the problem with that is as they fall closer to one another, that just increases the amount of gravitational wave energy that is being emitted. And so they have to fall towards each other even more rapidly. And that's why you get this sort of runaway effect until they merge. Now, this this process can be treated mathematically, either analytically or through use of a thing we call numerical relativity, which is basically simulating the Einstein equations, the equations of the general relativity in a supercomputer. And we can get a very precise prediction for what this kind of wave should look like. And that prediction depends on the details of the objects involved, their masses, their spins, their distance, their location on the sky. And so here you're seeing basically an overlap between the best fit numerical relativity template to that signal that we looked at before. And by doing that, we can actually get measurements of things like masses and distance, which is what's really powerful for doing astronomy. Traditionally, those things are hard to measure, especially distance. We get a direct measurement of the luminosity distance just from the waveform, which can be a very powerful thing when you're trying to do astronomy with this. Okay, so again, it was not so long ago that gravitational waves had not been detected. First ones in 2015. And now, although the detectors have actually been off for the last nearly 2 years due to some planned upgrades plus some COVID-related issues, they're still releasing some data from their old runs, and they have something like 50 different candidate events that they have announced or confirmed. This is a nice plot. It was produced by one of the Australian members of the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra collaboration. Virgo is a similar detector in Italy, and Kagra is a detector in Japan, all of the same basic type, looking for the same basic type of gravitational waves. So you can see there's dozens of events here. It's not the periodic table. It sort of is designed to look like one. What you're seeing here are the two masses of the two original objects, and then the mass of the total object. They're oriented in time from left to right, top to bottom. And the colors are sort of the different phases of the instrument as they were continuing to upgrade the instrument, make it more powerful. And already we're seeing really the motivation for doing this. We don't want to just detect one. It's not just about testing gravity. It's about doing astronomy. So we found one of the largest sort of small black holes, so not accounting for the massive black holes we find in the centers of galaxies. This is from GW 1905-21, 164 solar masses. And actually, I can see there's another one in there that's 175. So I think when I last wrote this slide, that one wasn't out there yet. Also one of the smallest black holes, or possibly largest neutron stars, of about 3 solar masses, so one or the other. And in general, this sort of population of heavy stellar remnant black holes that was previously, I would say, sort of unexpected or certainly unobserved. Plus, we've done a lot of science about gravity, a lot of science about even cosmology. We've done a measurement at the Hubble parameter using this distance measurement that we can do. So it's been a boon for astronomy, and we want to keep that going. So why do we want to go to space if this has been so successful on the ground? It's the same basic reason why we want to put other kinds of telescopes that observe with light in space. We want to avoid the disturbances that are on the ground or in the atmosphere, especially in the case of optical telescopes, as all of you observers are well aware. We were just talking about clouds, but other kinds of things that can cause trouble, particularly for certain wavelengths in which our atmosphere is not transparent. And this is the same idea for gravitational waves. We want to get away from the Earth. It can be a noisy environment, partly because of the Earth itself and partly because of the beings that inhabit it. And we can get to parts of the frequency spectrum, the gravitational wave frequency spectrum, that we just can't get to from Earth. So here is a cartoon of the gravitational wave spectrum. I've made a color so that sort of gets your brain thinking like the electromagnetic spectrum. But of course, this is a totally separate spectrum from light, but it has a lot of the same features. It ranges over many orders of magnitude, many decades in frequency between its lowest frequency sources and its highest frequency sources. And so those sources are plotted on the top, and they're just in these kind of generic regimes where you might have different types of astrophysical or cosmological sources. And there are many more sources that you could put on there that are perhaps more speculative, but these are the most sort of confidently predicted sources. And again, just like you have different types of telescopes and detectors to access different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum, we need different kinds of detectors to get to different parts of the gravitational wave spectrum. So LIGO, CAGRA, Virgo, the detectors that have been successful to date are all on the ground. And they are basically sensitive up to a few kilohertz and down to maybe tens of hertz. Or if you want to think about that in terms of wave period, it's sort of millisecond kind of wave periods, maybe tens of milliseconds, hundreds of milliseconds kind of periods for their waves. And you can see that in the data that I showed at the beginning of the talk. If you want to go to lower frequencies, and you can see if you look on the top part of this plot, there's a lot of different kinds of sources there. You need to go to space. And you need to go to space for the two reasons that I just talked about. One is, if you know anything about antenna theory for electromagnetic waves, you know that you always want to have your antenna be about the same size as the wavelength of the radiation you're looking for. You know, the optimal size actually turns out to be a quarter of the wavelength you're looking for. It's the same thing with gravitational waves. So for these millihertz kind of gravitational waves, that works out to a wavelength of a few million kilometers. So you want your detector to be a few million kilometers, which obviously doesn't fit on the Earth. In fact, it doesn't fit in the Earth-Moon system. You need to go away from the Earth-Moon system. And that's kind of the origin of the LISA concept. The other thing is that just at these lower frequencies, all those disturbances on the ground that come from, seismic disturbances, thermal disturbances, all kinds of things like that, that the ground-based detectors work very hard to avoid, they tend to just get worse as you go to lower frequencies, right? If you think about how much temperature varies in a room, it tends to vary a lot more over hours than it does over fractions of a second. Oh, and I should say, if people have questions, I can't see hands raised or whatnot, but I believe one of the moderators volunteered to keep an eye on that. So if someone has a pressing question, just raise your hand or somehow indicate it, and I'll try to answer it while we're here. And if we don't get to it, we can get to it at the end of the talk. Okay, let me talk a little bit more about the LISA concept. So as I said, it's a million kilometer observatory. It's a triangle. Of course, we don't fill the entire observatory with structure, right? That's way too big. It's three satellites that are linked with laser links, bidirectional laser links. We use a technology called drag-free test masses as our inertial references. And so I should explain what I mean by an inertial reference. The basic idea of a gravitational wave detector is you want to have two objects that are separated very far apart. So that's our million kilometer scale here. And you want to have them in free fall. So that is, you want to have them feeling nothing but gravity. And then if you watch those two objects and a gravitational wave comes by, you'll see that the distance between those objects changes over time. And that's exactly what LIGO does. LIGO does their objects in free fall in the horizontal direction by suspending them in a pendulum. So they're, of course, constrained in the vertical direction, but they're free to move in a horizontal direction. In LISA, we use a different technology, which is pretty neat, and I'll explain in a few slides here. And then we measure using lasers the distance between those free fall objects that are in these satellites over that million kilometers. And we need to do it to something like a picometer, or 10 to minus 12 meters, a trillionth of a meter, in order to pull out the gravitational wave signal. All right, so just to give you an idea of how big 2.5 million kilometers is, it turns out, and this is, so far as I can tell, a coincidence, especially because when I originally started working on LISA, we were making it a 5 million kilometer detector. But with the 2.5 million kilometer detectors, it pretty much exactly, you could inscribe the sun inside the constellation. Now, obviously, we won't put the constellation there. That would be a bad place to put it. But it turns out that that's how big it is. So, it's arguably the largest instrument, depending upon your definition of instrument, that's ever been conceived. Okay, let me talk a little bit more about the science, and then I'll get into the hardware. All right, so I'm going to use this plot, which is a little bit busy. I'm going to break down all the different pieces of this plot. So let me, before I do that, explain what we're looking at here. So this is a frequency spectrum. So what you're plotting on the x-axis, the horizontal axis, is the frequency of the waves, how fast they're going up and down. And so you see it ranges, it's around, the middle of it is around 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 2. So that's in millihertz or 10 millihertz. If you prefer to think about that in terms of wave period, it's tens of minutes to hours kind of wave period. The vertical axis is strain. This is the amount of stretching of space-time. And it's in both of these are on a logarithmic axis, just because it's an easier way to compactly represent a fairly wide band of the gravitational wave spectrum that we're interested in here. There is a green line there that is sort of a bucket shape. It goes from a high value at low frequencies down to some minimum, and then comes up again at high frequencies and has these wiggles in it. That is basically the limit of our instrument. So you can think about that as all the different noise sources that come from our instrument. If they were gravitational waves, that's how bright they would be on the sky, or that's how much equivalent gravitational wave energy our instrument noise produces. So we can only see sources which rise above that curve. So that's kind of our limit. Then all these other different colors that we're seeing here, the little purple dots, the blue stars, and actually this is intentional because I think a German guy built this plot, the German flag color tracks that are moving from left to right, and the other little tracks that are moving in different parts of the thing are different gravitational wave sources. And you can see all of them at least have some portion that lies above that green line, which means that we can detect them. And so these are all the various kinds of LISA sources that we expect to see. So this already, just from this picture, seeing all the different dots and tracks and slides and things that are in it, shows you sort of how rich the LISA science product will be. And it's nothing to take away from the ground-based detectors. As they continue to upgrade and improve their facilities, they will have many, many more sources, but they'll generally be of the same basic type. Black hole mergers, neutron star black hole mergers. Here we're going to have a whole bunch of sort of fundamentally different categories of sources, which is going to be really broaden the science appeal and the science opportunities for this mission. So now I'm going to step through these things one by one. So the first one I want to talk about is the most numerous source. And these are white dwarf binaries in our own galaxy, or possibly in some of the most nearby dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way. So I think, as many of you probably know, stars are quite common in the galaxy. Binary stars are quite common in the galaxy. Our solar system seems to be a bit odd in that our sun doesn't have a partner. And again, the most common remnant that happens at the end of the evolution of the types of stars in our Milky Way is a white dwarf. And so white dwarf binaries are pretty common in the Milky Way. We expect there's tens of millions of them in the Milky Way. Of those tens of millions, there are many which are radiating in gravitational waves in this LISA band, in this hours period or millihertz kind of frequency band. And so those things are all over the place. They kind of trace the structure of the galaxy. And the current thinking and current simulations are that we should be able to extract about 20,000 of these sources from our data stream. And so the little map that you're seeing on the bottom right is actually a plot, not of gravitational wave energy, but just probability density, where someone took a simulated galaxy and worked with, made a simulation of the LISA data set, and then tried to work out, okay, how can I extract all those tens of thousands of signals as individual little signals. And you can see some features. You can see something that looks like the galactic plane and a bulge, and then little hotspots that are individual systems that are being resolved. And so this is really sort of doing astronomy, the real classic kind of astronomy, but with gravitational waves. I'll show you at the end, you can even make a false color image using gravitational waves, which is kind of neat. Okay, the next type of source. This is, I'm moving upwards in distance here. So those are all galactic sources. Of course, those sources exist in other galaxies as well, but they're too faint for LISA to detect. So if we move to the types of sources that LIGO is detecting, so LIGO has taught us that there is a population of black hole binaries where the individual black holes have masses of a few tens the mass of our sun. If it turns out you take those sources and you run them back in time, right? So LIGO sees the last few orbits before they merge. But earlier on, those black holes have been orbiting one another for millions of years. And if you trace back in time far enough, you'll get to a point where their orbital frequency matches the LISA band. And that's what all these colored tracks are, the black and gray tracks, which are moving from left to right with time as the systems evolve. And actually the one highlighted in blue is the GW150914, the first gravitational wave detection. If LISA had been operating early enough in time, it would have actually detected that source. And because these sources evolve fairly rapidly, right? Those white dwarfs take a long time to evolve. The black holes, because they're heavy, fall towards each other more quickly. And so the time between which one of these sources would leave the LISA band and enter the LIGO band can be as short as a week, maybe a few weeks, which is kind of interesting. That's the plot on the bottom right is showing. There's the opportunity to do multi-band gravitational wave observing, where a LISA detector and a ground-based detector could see the same source. It would first appear in the LISA detector. It would eventually get too high frequency for LISA to see it. And then perhaps a week or so later, it would show up in the LIGO detector, which is another really interesting kind of astronomy. Our friends in electromagnetic land like to talk about multi-wavelength astronomy, and they usually mean, you know, observing the same object with radio and infrared and optical and x-rays. We might look at it in two different gravitational wave bands, which is kind of neat. Okay, moving the next step out in distance. These are a very weird kind of source, which is pretty much unique to LISA. We call it an extreme mass ratio in spiral, or EMRI. And there's a lot of things that are extreme about this. But what the word really means is the ratio of the masses. So I mentioned that, you know, we know there are a lot of black holes which we expect come from the explosion of massive stars, and they weigh, you know, a few tens of times the mass of our sun. We also know there are very massive black holes at the centers of most galaxies, like at our own galaxy, a few, you know, 4 million times the mass of our sun. Other galaxies have larger ones. We would expect that around these massive black holes, which are at the bottom of the potential well, the center of the galaxy, that you'll have very heavy stars and stellar remnants orbiting one of them. And if you have a star orbiting one of them and they get too close to the black hole, it can get torn apart, it gets disrupted. We see this as X-ray flares or optical flares. But if you have another black hole that's orbiting this big black hole, it can't get disrupted. And in fact, it orbits and it traces out these very crazy orbits. People probably know about some of the famous predictions of Einstein to explain the perihelion shift of Mercury, which comes from the fact that in general relativity, the two-body problem doesn't give you exactly closed orbits. Well, that shift, which is so subtle in our own solar system, if you put it in those same effects into a system where you have a black hole orbiting another black hole, they can get extreme, and you can see these crazy precession effects coming from the precession of the orbital plane and the precession of the periapsis as you're going around as well. And you get these very complicated gravitational wave waveforms. So the waveform is plotted there on the bottom. So instead of that sort of simple chirp, you see all these changes in frequencies. So you have high frequency, then low frequency, then back to high frequency. Same thing with the amplitude. The amplitude is getting large, but then small, and then large on all these different timescales, all superimposed with one another. So it's an extremely rich laboratory for understanding gravity. Because if this is this prediction, you imagine this is a template and you're trying to compare it with your wave. If you don't match every single little wiggle, that could be telling you something about the gravity theory that you have not matching your observations. So we're really hoping that we can use these things to put Einstein to kind of the ultimate test. Okay, then lastly, the sources that are many people's favorites. I go back and forth between the galactic binaries and these ones about my favorite source. And these are massive black hole binaries. So this is basically the LIGO type sources, two black holes falling into one another. And just like we've scaled up the arm length by a factor of a million, you can scale up the black holes by a factor of a million, and you get they come back into your frequency band. So these are million or 100,000 solar mass black holes, the type that are occupying the center of galaxies or dwarf galaxies. We know that galaxies are formed through an evolution, a hierarchical evolution, where you start out with small galaxies. Those small galaxies merge to form larger galaxies, and that process continues until the present day and continues after the present day. And we think that in many of those cases, if those galaxies merge and they have massive black holes at the centers of them, eventually in that merged remnant galaxy, you will have a merger of two black holes, two massive black holes. The plot on the bottom is actually showing from a snapshot from a simulation where they're not just simulating the gravitational orbit of these black holes around each other, but also the gas and dust that would be around those black holes and potentially emitting light. And so we could see these things, depending upon their mass, basically out past any electromagnetically detected signal other than the cosmic microwave background, and potentially out to redshifts of 20 or 30 if these objects exist. So if we want to understand the origin of black holes and kind of that connection with the origin of galaxies, this is going to be a really powerful tool for doing that. All right, and then lastly, this one's hard to put a picture on or certainly draw a signal from because we don't know. One of the motivations for doing a new kind of instrument like a gravitational wave detector is to look for things, the unexpected things. There's the famous Donald Rumsfeld quote about unknowns, both known and unknown. And so, of course, it's hard for me to speculate about unknown unknowns, but I'd say there are some known unknowns, things like intermediate mass black holes. Are there objects which are between the sort of tens of solar mass and these hundreds of thousands of solar mass black holes? Can you find 1,000 solar mass black holes? If so, and if they merge, you would find them with LISA. There's also a lot of physics that could be interesting, inflationary gravitational waves, cosmic strings, transitions of the vacuum as part of if there's sort of some leftover from inflation. Just about any kind of exotic physics phenomenon that you do will produce gravitational waves of some sort. And so that might be an opportunity to get something really unexpected. Okay, so I'm going to shift gears now, talk a little bit about the LISA technologies. So I've drawn in a very cartoony form that same strain curve that we were looking at. I guess I didn't do a good job of keeping the same color, but it's the same plot. We have frequency on the bottom axis and strain on the vertical axis. And I've simplified it. I've gotten rid of all of those pesky sources and just focused in on the detector, which was a green line that had the sort of bucket shape. I've now made it a red line. Apologies for that. So I'm just trying to show you different parts of this line and say what part of our instrument design influences the shape of this curve. So the first one I'll start with is the thing in the bottom, which is the arm length. So I already talked about this at the very, very beginning when I was sort of introducing things, that we need to size our detector to basically match the wavelength of the radiation that we're trying to detect. So since we're looking for millihertz or sort of million kilometer type waves, we want to have a few million kilometer detector. The number we've chosen for LISA, it's gone back and forth over the decades, but the one we're developing and which will fly is 2.5 million kilometers between the two satellites. Turns out that's about eight light seconds. So when you fire the laser from one spacecraft to the other, it takes 8 seconds before it arrives at the other spacecraft. The other thing the arm length does, it sort of sets the whole curve up and down because we're looking for stretching of space-time. The farther apart we put these objects, the bigger the signal gets. So that's the other reason why having a large arm is very helpful. Moving over on the left-hand side, there's a thing we call acceleration noise. It's basically how stable we can put these test particles. Remember, I said we want to have test particles that are only feeling gravity. Well, of course, you can never make things only feel gravity. There's other forces around. And so we characterize the performance of this thing by an acceleration, which is the acceleration due to forces that are not gravity. And we use a funny unit. We use the unit little g, which is the gravity that you would have on Earth's surface, 9.8 meters per second squared. But we want a really small amount of this kind of gravity, so this kind of acceleration. So we use a femto g, a 10 to the minus 15 g's. And then we have a funny spectral density unit of a square root of hertz, which usually makes the engineer's head explode when we try to explain what a per square hertz is, unless they've worked on radios, and then they understand. But forgetting about that, we're talking about a tiny fraction of that kind of very small acceleration. It has to be a very stable and still object. And then on the right-hand side, we work with a displacement noise. It's basically how well can we measure the distance between these two very stable particles. And again, I mentioned picometers, or 10 to the minus 12, or a trillionth of a meter is the scale that we're looking for. Okay, so how do we do that? So for the acceleration noise, I mentioned we use a technology called drag-free flight. And so let me explain how that works. So, and I'm gonna explain for people that have been really paying attention, you notice the spacecraft looks a little different. This is actually the LISA Pathfinder spacecraft. I think during the introduction, as mentioned, I worked on this spacecraft, which is a technology demonstrator led by the European Space Agency. And this is exactly what it was there to do. So you take your spacecraft, and inside it, you have a little hollow cavity. Now, I've drawn this cartoon as if the entire spacecraft was hollow, but in reality, the hollow cavity is just a little thing that surrounds this cubic test mass with a gaps of a few millimeters on each side of the cube. And so we get up into space. We actually have to hang on to this cube as we're launching up in the rocket and then very carefully let go of it. And once it's in there, it doesn't touch the walls of the spacecraft. And we want it to keep it from touching the walls so that it can just go about and only feel gravity. And we do that using sensors that are keeping track of where the test mass is, and then thrusters on the spacecraft to basically make the spacecraft follow the test mass. So I'll illustrate that in a simple little cartoon, a PowerPoint cartoon here. So the big force that we have when we get into deep space is solar radiation pressure. So we have our solar array there. It's giving us lots of nice voltage, but it's also pushing on us. We're getting momentum transfer onto the solar array. And so that causes the spacecraft to move into a non-inertial orbit, right? It's being pushed out of its pure free fall by this solar radiation pressure. The test mass, which is inside, isn't being, the sun's not shining on it. So it's still going about on its nice geodesic orbit. And if you waited for too long, the sun would basically push the spacecraft into the test mass. So we have sensors, we're sensing that, and we go ahead and we apply some thrusters. And it turns out the thrusters have to apply a few micronewtons. So the total solar radiation pressure load on this spacecraft, which is about a meter diameter solar deck, was something like 20 micronewtons. Which is like the weight of an insect on the Earth. So this 400 kilogram spacecraft, we had to apply the weight of an insect kind of thrust to it to get it to balance against the solar radiation pressure. And if you do this and you control it, the test mass stays centered, or actually the spacecraft stays centered around the test mass, and the test mass doesn't feel any additional disturbance other than anything that's sort of resident on the spacecraft itself. So here's some pictures of the actual hardware. So this is the big picture there is of the test mass itself. It was made of a gold platinum alloy and then coated with gold, not just because we were trying to be flashy, but because we were trying to make it have a very low magnetic susceptibility so that it wouldn't couple to magnetic fields, which are hard to shield from. And we place it inside that little housing there. It weighs a few kilograms. It was 46 millimeters on a side. So, you could kind of hold it in your hand, although they never would let us hold the gold test masses in the hand, and pretty heavy, a few kilograms. And there's a picture on the upper right of one of the thrusters. Actually, NASA provided, there's two types of thruster technologies that were tested. NASA provided one of them called a colloidal micronewton thruster, which is works kind of like your inkjet printer. And you can think about the whole LISA Pathfinder spacecraft as kind of a LISA arm in one spacecraft. We actually had two of these test masses. They were oriented with a little separation between each other. We could fly the spacecraft around one or the other, suspend the one which we weren't flying around, and then we had a little laser interferometer that was measuring the distance between the two test masses. So it launched from Kourou in French Guiana, where the European Space Agency does most of their launches. And we got this nice plot. So this is another one of these spectrum plots, but we're not plotting gravitational waves. We're just plotting the acceleration noise. And this curve here that you see with the little tiny wedge at the top is actually what we had written down and promised that we were going to do. The dashed hatched curve is what we thought we would need for LISA. So we said, you know, we're going to not go all the way to LISA. We're going to go most of the way there, since no one had ever done this before. And then the blue line is what we got when we first turned the spacecraft on. And then you talk about interesting coincidences. This, we first released our test masses and started taking data the week after LIGO announced their gravitational wave detection. So it was about 6 months after the detection had actually occurred, but it was embargoed and wasn't public. And so we had all this excitement, you know, all at the same time on these two activities that had been going on for decades. And it, within the same week, we had, you know, major events in both of them. It was a pretty exciting time to be working in this field. So after working on that thing and tuning up the instrument for a bit, we got down to the red curve, which, you know, if you're not used to doing this kind of work, you say, oh, it's not that much farther down. But you notice it's a log scale, so it's actually a factor of several improvement. And it was just an incredible, beautiful curve. The instrument worked really well, gave us a lot of confidence going forward that we can build LISA. Okay, let me talk about the other side of the curve, the other part of the problem, which is how do we make this distance measurement? So the basic thing we use is a technique called heterodyne interferometry. So I'll talk about the interferometry part first. Interferometry is just a fancy way of meaning I'm going to use the wave nature of light to make a very precise measurement. So we know, you know, light has wavelengths that are, you know, they're pretty small. So we use an infrared light that's got about a micron wavelength, and we need to get to a picometer. So that already tells me that I'm kind of in the right ballpark by a factor of a million. So if I can measure to a millionth of a wavelength using light that has a one micron wavelength, then I can do picometer measurements. So that's basically the idea. Heterodyne means that we have multiple laser systems that are at slightly different frequencies. So that's the different frequency, heterodyne. And what we mean there is we can't do the LIGO arrangement where they send light from a central laser out two arms, reflect it and bring it back. Because we're going so far on these 2.5 million kilometer arms, we lose almost all the light. So we collect 10 to the minus 10 of the light that we transmit. So if we tried to reflect it, you know, then it'd be 10 to minus 20. So we basically just would have no photons. So what we do instead is we borrow a technique that's a little bit like an RF radio transponder, right? So we have our laser and on our spacecraft, we pick up a little bit of the light that's coming from the distant spacecraft, and then we compare it with a copy of the light on our own spacecraft. And if we want to send that light back, we can basically command our laser to repeat the phase information that's coming in from the weak signal from the very far spacecraft. We can blast it back out with our bright laser. And then when we collect the light back at the original spacecraft, we can compare it again with the light we're sending out, and we can get a comparison of what happened as if there was like a mirror, but it's like a mirror with a booster in the middle of it or an amplifier in the middle of it. So we get all these six one-way measurements doing that. So we also have kind of a technology demonstrator for this, which was a little bit, not sort of unintentional, but a little fortuitous. So there's a mission called GRACE, the Gravity Recovery and Climate Explorer, which is a US-German collaboration. It's been going for quite a while. In fact, it's actually no longer operating. But its mission is to look for changes in the Earth's geoids. So basically changes in the gravitational potential of Earth, mostly caused by climate effects, ice melting, seasonal variations of water, that kind of thing. And it works by having two satellites in low Earth orbit that follow one another. And basically, if they go over a mass concentration like the Himalaya or an ice cap or something like that, the first spacecraft gets pulled ahead a little bit by the gravity, and it stretches out the constellation. And then the second one comes across, and it sort of catches back up. And so this has worked very well. It's produced these kind of maps that you're seeing on the bottom there, and tons of interesting science. And they wanted to keep this science going. So they decided they were going to build a second copy. And it was recognized by both the US and Germany, who were both involved with LISA, that there was an opportunity to take some of the original LISA technology and do a demonstrator of a laser link. Their main link is a microwave link, because that gets them enough precision, but we could at least demo a laser link. And so that was sort of rushed in there. It flew on the GRACE follow-on, which is a sort of data continuity mission for GRACE. It's called a laser ranging instrument on GRACE follow-on. And here's yet another spectrum. You get the sense now that I spent a lot of my days looking at spectra of the GRACE signal, actually data coming out of the laser ranging interferometer. Now, Earth, you know, it's got a much larger signal than the LISA gravitational wave signal. So they don't need as sensitive an interferometer. Also, the signal is always on. You can't sort of like, you know, turn the Earth off and see how well the instrument works the way we did with LISA Pathfinder. So we can't get a direct measurement of how well it works. But at the very highest frequencies, you can see that big purple curve drops really steeply and then hits a sort of flat floor. So we think that that's actually the limit of our interferometer. And it's limited because we only have a single arm. Typically, we use a pair of arms if we want to do a really precise measurement, because we want to do a differential between two similar size arms. And so we're seeing, based on our models, exactly what we expect to see, which is really really encouraging. Also gave us a chance to fly some components, a laser that's very similar to the LISA laser, photoreceivers that are very similar, and just build up some operations experience, like how do you align the laser? How do you do the initial acquisition? That kind of thing, which will be certainly very helpful as we move forward on LISA. Okay, so last couple slides on status and outlook of the mission. So we are currently in what's called a formulation phase. That if you want to get specific, ESA, which is the lead agency, is in phase B1, if that means anything to you. On this timeline here, the next major milestone is a thing we call mission adoption, or I should say Europe calls mission adoption. This is where basically the design has been studied to a degree by which there is a confident costing and schedule. So we know how much it's going to cost and how long it's going to take, you know, really down to a pretty high level of detail. And also importantly, the sort of roles and responsibilities. So these missions are always collaborations. They're never a single payer. And so we've, you know, worked out, well, what is it that the US is going to provide? What is it that ESA is going to provide as an agency? What is it that the individual European countries, which usually make separate contributions, you know, France, Germany, the Netherlands, the UK, et cetera, also are going to contribute? And so those things have to all be held together. Typically, after adoption for a mission of this size, this would be one of the larger missions that ESA has ever done. It would take 8 to 10 years, maybe even longer, because this is a 3-spacecraft mission. So we're talking about a launch sometime in the mid-2030s. It takes about 18 months to get to our operations orbit, and then to do something like a year to get the whole constellation set up and running. Maybe we could squeeze that down to 6 months, and then do 4 years of science, and then we would have all of our consumables and our orbit designed to do an additional 6 years of science. So if you stack that all up, this thing would be still operating in the mid-2040s. So that's why I said I'm maybe halfway done. And that's assuming I hand it off to somebody else. So what are we doing? So we're doing a lot of what I call systems engineering. This is the hard work of developing all those requirements. So we need to start with those science objectives, but I need to go and trace okay, I want to measure this kind of black hole down to exactly how stable I need my laser to be, and then down to exactly, you know, what temperature the laser crystal is allowed to be, all that kind of thing. And you need to do this for all of the systems and establish all the interfaces, right? There's a lot of design choices that need to be made, where you could say, well, we could do it this way, or we could do it that way. And especially when you have a multi-party collaboration, right? You might make an engineering decision which is roughly equal between two different choices. You say, well, that design will work just as well as this design. But you know, design A might cost one party a whole bunch of money, and design B might cost another party a whole bunch of money. And so, you know, you end up with management and politics and other things involved as well as just engineering. So in practice, that means going through lots of stacks of, these days, digital paper. So reading lots of documents. It means lots of meetings. They used to be in-person meetings, like one at Goddard here above. Now they're all Zoom meetings, which has its pluses and minuses. That means I don't need to spend as much time on airplanes going to Europe, but I do have to get up at 3 a.m. and do Zoom calls because that's when the European day starts. So it's that's the hard work and what working on a space mission really looks like. We also are doing a lot of technology development. So despite the successes we had on Pathfinder and Grace Follow-On, there's a few components which weren't demonstrated on either of those missions. The most important, I think, are telescopes. So we don't use our telescopes to form images, but we use them to basically efficiently transmit the light between the satellites so that we can get as much of it as we can. Now, the hard part about this is our telescope has to be path length stable to picometers in this hour sort of time scale, which means it needs to be made of all glass. So you're seeing this prototype here designed at NASA and developed it with L3 Harris in Rochester. It's the back of it, lightweighted, but it's made out of a single piece of Zirdur glass. The entire structure plus the primary plus the metering structure plus the secondary. So it's quite a beast. It's only 30 centimeters diameter, which, you know, is great for doing observing. But when I talk to my colleagues that work on JWST, you know, they kind of laugh at me. They say, your telescope's only 30 centimeters. You know, it's not 6 meters. But 30 centimeter telescopes can be hard to build too if they had to be picometer stable. We also need some lasers that are a little bit more powerful, a few watts, but also have to be very stable. And the big thing is we had to move from what I call demonstrators, right? So both the laser ranging instrument on Grace Follow-On and LISA Pathfinder, you know, they weren't operational missions that had to work consistently day in, day out for years. And so there's a reliability kind of issue. We also had to have just a lot more copies of everything, right? We don't just need one telescope, we need six. We don't just need one laser, we need 12. So that changes the way you approach things. It's not quite, you know, building 1,000 Starlink satellites like SpaceX is doing, but it's also not just building a one-off JWST either. So there's some interesting engineering effort that goes on in that. And then the last part of sort of technology development I wanted to talk about is really the technology of data analysis. So as I mentioned a few times in the talk, you know, we will get tens of thousands of signals out of LISA. Now, gravitational wave detectors are not like telescopes in the sense that they are not pointed. They're generally all sky or nearly all sky detectors, which is good because I don't need to know where to point it, but it's bad because it means I get all my information all at once. And so if you're gonna make any use of it, you need to be able to extract it. And we do a bunch of work on that. This plot here is from what we call a LISA data challenge. And this is where we get a group of people to sort of build a simulated LISA data set with varying degrees of fidelity. And you can see this one is a time series where all those different signals that I had shown in that very busy spectrum are now represented in the time domain. And you can see there's a key here where you have the different signals, but the real thing you would get would be, you know, just one big fuzzy signal that's made up of all these different sine waves and instrument noise and everything else. And you have to go take a computer code that can go efficiently match templates against all these different things and pick out all the signals without knowing which ones are there ahead of time. So that's a technology in and of itself. And just to show you some recent progress on that kind of thing, because it's something that that myself and others work on, is this is now that same data. I'll flip back to it in a moment, where we've now gone and fit for a few thousand sources in that data of different types, at least of three different types. And now we've made a sky map. So we've said, okay, in there, based on that thing, I can tell that there is a galactic binary of this mass, and it's at this place in the sky, and I drew a little ellipse. And I can tell that there's a massive black hole, and it merged at this time, which is what those numbers are encoding, and it's at this part on the sky, and I can draw those ellipses. So it's kind of interesting that you can flip back from just this piece of time series information, which is really just you know one number that's varying with time, and you can turn that back into this kind of map and really a bunch of other information that's coming in there. And if you take that to the next level, I teased at the beginning that you can make a false color image. This is taking a similar data set to that that had these galactic binaries in it. And here, this is just sort of a fun student project. We took the gravitational wave information and we tried to make it as close to a false color image as we could. So we took the color of the image as the gravitational wave frequency. So the bluer and purpler colors are higher frequency gravitational waves. And then we took the intensity of the image from the gravitational wave energy flux. So we took basically a combination of the frequency and the amplitude and formed an energy flux. And so the brighter areas have more gravitational waves and the darker areas are less. And then the colors are showing you what frequency is kind of dominating that particular pixel. And so you can see again, sort of the plane. This is an all sky image of the Milky Way in galactic coordinates. So you can see sort of the plane in the galaxy. You can see a bulge. You can see individual little magenta and cyan spots, which are individual sources that are somewhat well localized, at least by gravitational wave standards. And you can see some bigger yellow smudges, and that's telling you that the lower frequency ones aren't localized as well as the higher frequency ones because they're just not measured as well. So it's kind of an interesting image. We'll certainly play around with some of these things, but maybe this will be something we'll see hanging on the wall at Goddard in 2040. Okay, well, that was what I had, and I haven't checked the time, but I think I didn't use up the entire time, but I'm happy to answer plenty of questions since there weren't any during the talk. If I don't answer your questions, or even if I do, you may want to check out some of the various websites. I've listed three of the main ones here. There's the official ESA site. It does not get updated very often, but if you want official information from the European Space Agency, which is leading the mission, that's where you should go. We have a NASA site that we try to keep relatively up to date and try to make it accessible at a variety of levels. That's the lisa.nasa.gov. And then this LISA Consortium, which is a sort of grassroots organization, they have a fairly elaborate website as well, lots of information. And if you're a practicing scientist and you're interested in contributing or learning, getting a little bit more active, you can even consider joining the LISA Consortium, apply to do so. And that's what I had. So I think I'll maybe come out of full screen mode so I can see the Zoom window and see if there's any questions.
Fantastic. Questions? Maybe you can unmute yourself. Ask John.
Okay, I actually have three questions. Is LISA plan to also measure the polarization of the G waves, both linear and circular?
Yes. Well, let's see. So for people that don't know about gravitational wave polarization, they have a polarization. The polarization is a little bit different than electromagnetic polarization because they're a spin-2 tensor. So they have basically a plus polarization or cross polarization. So because we have a triangular detector that's not at a 90 degree angle and we complete the triangle, we do get some information about the relative amplitude of those two polarizations instantaneously. Additionally, since many of our signals are long-lived, we can observe them at from different angles and different orientations as our constellation orbits around the sun. I didn't show the orbit, but it's basically an orbit that's a Earth-like heliocentric orbit that forms a constellation that's inclined to the ecliptic at 60 degrees and tumbles once a year. That's that the constellation orbit looks like. And so for a source like these galactic binaries that are on all the time, over a year, we'll observe them with different angles, which also gives us some polarization information. The general relativity predicts that there's just two polarizations, this plus and cross one. Some alternative theories of gravity, like the Brans-Dickey theory, include some other polarization states that could be present. And certainly we will look for them. And if we see them, someone will get a trip to Stockholm.
Okay, another question is, the solar wind is very active. There are CMEs, there are solar radio bursts, and there are all sorts of plasma waves and even magnetic reconnection. Has that been taken into account?
Yes, but we're always learning more. In fact, I actually, myself and a couple people wrote a paper on this last year, I guess, because we thought we might've missed something. And it was actually a researcher in Czechoslovakia published a paper saying we weren't going to see anything because of the solar wind. And we went back and we looked and we said, well, didn't we look at this? And we had, but it wasn't quite the same thing that he was talking about. So we went and did another dive onto it. And indeed, there are a couple of kinds of effects that the sun can have on the spacecraft. One is through charging of the test mass. I didn't mention that. So the test mass can build up electrical charge. We actually have to discharge the test mass by applying UV light. That's actually another one of the NASA contributions, is the UV discharge system. The other thing it can do is it actually can cause dispersion in the laser links. As a solar plasma goes through those laser links, they can cause what looks like a path length difference. That was what we just looked at. And you know, for most of the time, I think we should be okay. It's possible that during some really, really loud solar events, you know, really energetic solar events, we may get a signal. I think those look to be pretty rare. It would be a pretty high sigma event. And then in that case, you know, maybe we can be a useful solar observatory for a few days.
Okay. I have one other conceptual comment. For the ground-based observatories, is it correct that even if the source of the G waves is on the opposite side of the Earth from one of those observatories, it won't notice the presence of the Earth at all?
That's right.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
So gravitational waves don't couple very efficiently, which makes them hard to detect. But then the advantage is that, you know, they can just move through matter. So we don't have to worry about extinction or anything like that. So that's it. For example, with the white dwarfs that we want to look at, the Milky Way with Lisa, we can see right through the galactic center and see the ones on the other side just fine. Which actually, you know, it gives us an interesting handle on maybe measuring the Milky Way. Now, we don't know whether the white dwarf binary distribution tracks the you know, main sequence stellar population, right? Because it's an older population. But you know, maybe we can elucidate some things about galactic structure from maps of the white dwarf binaries.
Thank you.
Others, please.
I have a question. You mentioned that one of the factors that go into the templates is the location on the sky. And that kind of surprised me. Is that just due to the sensitivity of the instruments in different directions, or is there some other factor there?
Yeah, right. So that's a great and very insightful question. So as I mentioned, the detectors are basically all sky detectors. There is a small amount of difference in sensitivity as you move across the plane. We get most sensitivity basically perpendicular to the plane of the constellation, and we get minimum sensitivity in the plane of the constellation, but we still get some. Now, the key is that our detector orbits and our sources are observed for a long time. So even the massive black hole signals, which are transient, we observe them for months, typically, maybe years for the lighter ones. So that means that we get both a frequency modulation from our orbit, and we get an amplitude modulation as our detector constellation plane basically wobbles on the sky. And so we can use those effects to pick up those frequency modulations and amplitude modulations from the orbit are sky position dependent. Okay. And that's how we get most of our directional sensitivity. And for very high frequency waves, once the waves start to become similar in wavelength to the size of the constellation, we actually can see sort of a temporal effect where basically the waves wash over the constellation and we can see, one arm affected before the other arms. That's a very cartoony picture, but that's effectively what we're seeing. And that also has a very, very directional dependence. Another way of saying that is that the antenna pattern, the sensitivity on the sky, while it's all sky uniform for low frequencies, when you start to get to the wavelengths that are comparable to the size of the detector, that's no longer the case.
Hey, thank you.
Wayne, unmute yourself and ask your question.
I have a question, yes. What do you mean by plane of a constellation?
It's a triangle, so it has a plane. Let's see if I can find the... Yeah. The plane defined by these three points or by two of those arms.
Wayne, it's the constellation of satellites, not...
Correct. Yeah, it's a constellation of satellites.
Yes, a constellation of satellites. Okay, I understand. Right. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Wayne is a real astronomer.
Yeah, please.
I would be
embarrassed if you guys asked me what constellation or something it was in, because of course it's going to be all of them at some point.
Other questions, please.
Well, a constellation has no meaning. It's just a collection of stars. A lot of people think that all those stars are associated.
They're not.
But they are not. Usually, they are not.
It's an area, not a volume.
Right.
Yeah, you should tell me what kind of telescope you'd need to see these. I was very interested to watch people taking pictures of JWST as it was on its way to L2. We're going to be significantly farther away. We're going to be like about 50 million kilometers from Earth. And the satellites will be a few meters in diameter. And probably the shiny side's not going to be facing. So it's going to be hard to see.
Hard to see, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it'll be possible. I had a question about the delta V. You're going to need to maintain the useful orientation. And how accurate is that 60-degree angle between the satellites have to be maintained, and what delta V do you need to do that? I assume the orbits in general are in a drift orbit, so it says 19 to 23 degrees for the Earth-Sun triangle, orbit to the center of your triangle, and I guess that drifts then. Otherwise, you'd need quite a bit of delta V to get it to stop and actually be a one-year period if it were if you tried to maintain the sun, Earth-Sun spacecraft angle. You have those very small thrusters to counteract the solar radiation pressure, but I just wondered what the delta V magnitudes are to maintain the angular configuration to the accuracy that you need it or you want.
Right. Right. Okay. So, so actually, this is one of the probably most clever design solutions of the entire thing. It was worked out by a scientist named Pete Bender in the early 80s. Is he worked out this set of orbits, which are almost these magic orbits, where if you place the constellation in this orientation, so you notice that the plane of the three satellite constellation is inclined at the ecliptic by 60 degrees. And each of these are in an independent Earth-like heliocentric orbit. And were it not from the perturbations coming from the Earth, and then, you know, next most important thing, Jupiter, you would keep this constellation exactly fixed in both its, you know, angles and its arm lengths for forever, right? It just, they just orbit one another and they tumble and they keep this thing. Because of, so you know, at that point you wouldn't need any delta V, but because one of the satellites is periodically closer to the Earth basically tugs on it. You get a tidal, you can think of it as the Earth applying a tide on this triangular constellation, and it starts to distort it. And so you get a periodic distortion of the constellation. And if you can think about it in different ways, so the opening angle of the constellation, which would, you know, it's nominally equilateral triangle, so that'd be 60 degrees, it changes by about half a degree with an annual period. And then it changes with there's some sort of secular effects, and that's what this 19 to 23 degree it's are. So there's different strategies we'll use, and this is one of the things that's still in the design, but basically you get more stability, that is less flexing of the constellation the farther you are away from the Earth, but there's a communications issue, is the farther are you, we get it's more difficult. So we actually design these orbits where you actually sort of slide towards the Earth and then slide back away. And this is all with that, all passively. So we basically don't need any, or we don't plan to use any large delta V once we're in our operational orbit. We just use the micro thrusters to keep the things in their orbits, and that's it.
Okay, but what do you need? What sort of delta Vs do you need to achieve the initial orbit?
To get there. Okay, so there's actually a trade between our how long we're willing to wait between launch and establishing our orbit, because what you basically do is you go out, you wait, and then you come back in, and so you can you know go out further. And then come back in sooner, as you can use more delta V and get to your operational orbit more quickly, or you can use less delta V and take a longer time to get there. I don't have the number off the top of my head. I'd have to look at what the current orbital transfer orbit analysis is using, but it's not substantial. We don't use the micro thrusters for that. We'll plan to either use an electric propulsion because it's quiet once we turn it off. For at least the Pathfinder, we didn't go to this orbit. We went to an L1 halo orbit, and we used a chemical propulsion, just a simple biprop, and then we jettisoned it once we got to our orbit and spent the rest of the mission using our micro thrusters.
Yeah. Andre Coleman, you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering what kind... Are there any issues that would arise with space debris in the area of orbit that you're thinking of? And if so, how are you going to solve them?
Right. So, I mean, obviously you can never say never. And if we were to hit a big chunk of something, that would be bad. That's bad for all the satellites. Compared to anything in low Earth orbit or even around the moon, you know, there's not a lot that's out here and there's a lot of space, right? You can see it's bigger than the entire Earth Moon system by a lot. So that part we're not so much worried about. We do have to worry about, you know, natural space debris or various rocks and such that are going through there. And if the bigger ones, you know, it's less likely that you're going to hit a spacecraft, but even if they come close to it, you can get a gravitational pull. They could potentially, you know, mask a gravitational wave signal or just cause something weird that you'd have to have to deal with. We also worry about little micrometeoroids actually hitting the spacecraft and pushing it out of its orbit. And we, in fact, actually saw this on at least the Pathfinder. So you could, you know, you'd be sitting there carefully balancing against the solar wind, and then you get a whack, and the whole satellite would rock because as its control system was trying to compensate for this extra momentum transfer. And a group of us actually wrote a paper where we said, okay, I should be able to look at this momentum transfer, you know, coming from these things, and work out, go backwards and figure out how big of a meteorite, you know, might have hit our, at least the momentum, hit our spacecraft and where it hit, because I could measure that momentum transfer, both angular, you know, how much spin was imparted on the spacecraft and how much linear momentum was imparted on the spacecraft. And so we actually published a paper where we compared, we got a few dozen pretty confident events during the 18-month mission. And we were actually able to publish a paper with some people that do models of the dust in the inner solar system and say, okay, well, it looks like it's, you know, maybe a little bit like this model, a little bit like that model. Nothing revolutionary there, but it's kind of neat to do do a science experiment with a mission that had like no outward facing instruments. But yeah, so that's part of our error budget as well, is you know, little impulsive momentum transfer.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I don't see any raised hands other than the people that have already asked questions. You want to just ask a question, unmute yourself and speak, please.
Okay. What was I going to ask?
We can hear you, David.
Yeah, I know. But I actually forgot what I was going to ask now.
Okay. Well, if you remember it, ask before we sign off, please.
Okay.
That's unusual. David doesn't forget very many things.
He's still human.
Yeah, I remember now. Would there be any advantage or possibility, instead of flying an equilateral triangle configuration, of flying four satellites with a tetrahedron configuration?
So certainly you could get more information about the gravitational waves by doing that. You can get even more polarization information and directional information if you had a complete tetrahedron. It's already kind of awkward for us to be doing these sort of two instruments at the same time, right? I got to track both of the other satellites. If I had a third one and another plane, people have actually looked at that, or even an octahedron kind of thing. It turns out it's probably a better engineering choice to have a pair of triangles, which are then crossed, right? So actually that 60 degree orbit solution works with this. It doesn't care whether the 60 degrees is up or down, both work. So you could have, and then you can also rotate the constellation this way in the plane. So you can make like a Star of David pattern. You could make a crossed, kind of constellation pair. You can separate them, have one ahead of the Earth, one behind the Earth. And it turns out that those kinds of configurations are probably much simpler to engineer and give you similar, if not even sometimes better, benefit.
Good.
Also, at some point, areas, when you start having more detectors, you multiply the expense by a lot.
You certainly do. So, as I mentioned, you know, we're already talking about having, you know, we're in the sort of small scale manufacturing, which is awkward, right? Most space hardware it's all hand built, and so that's why things cost so much, because you can't just go order one. You have to build everything by hand. You know, the cables have to get built by hand by highly trained and therefore highly paid people. And so trying to move that up, if you needed to have, you know, six spacecraft instead of three, it gets really difficult. You're not quite at the point of where you can really invest in manufacturing to have an assembly line of spacecraft, but you're almost there. So I think, yeah, if you needed to go to that kind of thing, you need to do some engineering changes, really in the sort of engineering and project management changes more so than any kind of technology change.
I think QR Quasar wants to ask a question.
Yeah, thanks. Are there, this is hard to formulate, are there any areas where you think you might find surprising results which will lead you to new problems to investigate?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, as I think, as I said during part of the talk, that's kind of the ultimate motivation for doing this, right? It's looking at a new place. And, you know, for me personally, that was what got me really interested in this mission. I had done some stuff in some sort of fundamental physics areas, and I was really interested in instrumentation. But a lot of times, you know, you're building this exquisite instrumentation and you expect to measure zero, right? You know, sure, there's a theory that says possibly you're going to measure some violation and it'll be a huge big news if you do, but everyone's expecting you're just going to measure a better zero. And this was an opportunity where there were sort of, you know, sources we knew were going to be there. You know, the science is you know, at the same time, very exciting, but still pretty high confidence that it's there because you're doing something new. And so I like that combination of, you know we're going to go see these different kinds of gravitational wave sources, but probably as soon as we turn it on, there'll be something that we don't expect. And I think, you know, the first LIGO result was kind of like that, right? Everybody was expecting a neutron star merger to be the thing that we would see first with LIGO, because we knew about them from gamma ray bursts. But we saw a black hole first. And actually, some people were sort of surprised that they saw one so early, right? Because they hadn't reached the sensitivity they really thought they would need. But as soon as, you know, I didn't have any embargoed information on LIGO, but I knew a lot about it. So as soon as I heard the rumors that they had an event, I was like, oh, it must be a black hole, right? Because the only way they could have had something that early with that sensitivity was that it had to be really loud, which meant it had to be really big. And the astronomers had to all of a sudden say, well, where do you get these big black holes from? And it's actually, we used to call them stellar origin black holes. And some of the theorists are saying, you know, don't call them that anymore, because we're not sure they're coming from massive stars. Maybe they're coming from somewhere else. Mm. And so, you know, that's a perfect example. You know, their very first detection, it answered some questions and it also raised some questions.
Uh-huh. Thank you much. Same.
Jeff, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do have another question. When you saw the first results from Pathfinder, were you afraid something was wrong because it was so much better than you were expecting?
That's another good question. So I think Pathfinder really, to me, illustrated the difference between the ground-based and particularly the sort of experimental physics approach to doing things and the space approach, right? So the way we do an experimental physics project, the way I was trained and the way, you know, basically LIGO works is you put the thing together, you turn it on, it doesn't quite work, and then you just go tinker with it until it works. And in space, that's not the culture at all, because it's too expensive to tinker with it. You can't afford to have things not working. So you spend all this time and money up front doing testing and testing and adjustments and tinkering and all of that. So then when you do turn it on, you know, once you get past the scary parts of the launch pad, like, you know, if it does, you know, if it works at all, then it tends to work quite well. And with Pathfinder, the big thing was, you know, it was very difficult to replicate the environment of space. Space is a nice quiet environment for doing precision measurement. It's hard to make that environment. Couldn't replicate the environment we were going to space for. And I think you see that with JWST too, right? It took a huge amount of time and all this money. You say, oh my gosh, and it's never going to work. We turn it on, it seems to be working, you know, perfectly, which is, that's the point. That's why we had to spend so much money. It was to get it right.
Jeff, Norman, do you have a question?
No.
Anyone else, please? This has really been a marvelous talk.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry we couldn't do it in person.
Yeah, thank you very much.
On mute and clap. Andre, do you have a question? And Todd. This is really marvelous.
All right, well, I'm happy I could join you guys. And you know, we're not too far. I know people probably scattered around the whole DC metro area. Somebody said they were from Arizona too. I'm actually originally from New Mexico, so I'm from out that way as well. Once things are a little bit more normal, there are, you know, Goddard's not too far away, so I'm sure we can do something like this again.
Terrific.
David Dunham has homes in Arizona as well as in Maryland.
Oh, okay.
In Prince George's County. And some of our members, due to age, have scattered to places like Florida, like Wayne Warren.
And
we also have some very new members, at least one member of my current Astronomy 101 class, who's actually a junior in Wilson High School in the District of Columbia.
Oh,
great. He's probably the youngest member, the youngest person we have today that I'm aware of, but I'm not aware of everybody's ages. But
all right, well, I'm going to sign off, but thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for the really good explanations.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
It's really marvelous.
It's a very good